Freedom of the press is only guaranteed when you own the press.
It's time to hear the other side of the news.
Communication breakdown. Pause for the message. Wake up. Every station is a gentrification. Global syndication is the shaping of the nation. ABC, Disney, NBC, GE, Murdoch is Foxy, and with a hint, he owns a pen, the camera, the sword, buying coke, buying Ford, getting broke, getting bored.
The other side of the news.
What we want, what we need, what we want, what we need. But do we even know who plans to see? You think the media works for you, but it's a job for them. They're just selling fruit. Flim flam diagram, data jam, handicap, caught it. Yo, you bought it. My mind is a profitable thing to waste. You want another taste, babe? Till freedom is a rumor.
Today we're in studio with Michael Desnoyers and Craig Smith. Both of them live in the area of the Atropolis Zone. One is a businessman, and Craig Smith is a farmer who has been doing farming on Smith Road, named after his family, who has been there for hundreds of years. They're both in studio today to talk about the problems that they've seen with the coming Atropolis, how it's affected their neighborhood, how it's going to affect their land. Michael Desnoyers and some of the residents he's rounded up have put a complaint into the OMB board about the kind of urban sprawl that's happening. Michael, maybe you would just like to start here and give us just a bit of background and to some of the concerns that you have.
Some of these proposed changes, lack of public notice, seems a little bit indifference on the part of the council in listening to some of the concerns. So it's gotten quite a lot of background support from a number of other people as well.
Would you just mind describing the neighborhood for people who don't live up there, they've never seen it? If you wouldn't mind, just to kind of give a visual explanation of where you are, how close to the airport. What does the airport sound like already that's going on up there?
Well, obviously, airport noise is not something that everybody finds attractive. We're right off the end of the runway, probably about 3 or 4 kilometers off the end of the runway. Most of the property up there is farming community. There are a number of office residences up in that area, but it's fairly sparse, except in the area directly around the airport off of Glenbrook Road and 20 Road. So there's a higher density closer into the airport. Now, the street that I'm on is an older street. It's been there about 40, 50 years. We have about 30 homes on it. But we're directly in the flight path. As everybody knows, the airport has been there since the Second World War in some form or another. Prior to 1990, the amount of traffic in and out of the airport was significantly less than we have today. It's since 1994 when City Council and Tradeport entered into a private-public partnership that the airport really has expanded. One of the competitive advantages that the airport has is the fact that it is 24/7 operation. There's very little restrictions at night, so it becomes a big advantage to cargo carriers to be able to fly in and out at any time of the evening. Unfortunately, that's when any sort of loud noises are at their worst, is in the evening. If you get some heavy overcast weather at night, any aircraft that go overhead, the sound is somewhat magnified because it then gets directed all down towards the ground. So it can be quite negative at times.
How bad does it get?
In our particular home, we don't have central air conditioning, so we like to enjoy the night air, and we keep our windows open. I can recall one time when my daughter was much younger, an aircraft flew overhead, and whatever it was, I thought the walls were going to come down crumbling around us. It woke her up. She cried. She came down into the bedroom.
Does it actually shake your house?
By the time they make it to my house, they're not at the top of their takeoff path, but they're probably under 3,000 feet. I wouldn't say it shakes your house, but it sure rumbles it real good.
You were saying it was there since 1990, so for 4 years, there was basically just cargo flights going out of this airport, and they were, a lot of them were at night. Was it as bad then as it is now?
Well, I actually moved into the property that we have. We purchased the property in 1993 and built a new home there prior to the agreement between Tradeport and the city. So we lived up in Ancaster since 1985, but in a different area. And although we could hear the aircraft, we weren't as affected by it as we are now. What I meant was prior to the relationship relationship between Tradeport and the city in 1994. There, the city ran the operation, and there were, we all know it, Nation Air and others that were flying in and out of Hamilton, well, Mount Hope Airport at the time. But the number of flights was very small in comparison to what it is today. Most of the flights that have been in the last 5 years are during the daylight hours, WestJet and Greyhound. I remember when Greyhound was flying out of their, some of their very, very early flights that headed west would leave at 6 or 7 in the morning, and they typically used much older aircraft, which were Stage 2 aircraft, which were really, really bad. You could literally no longer see the aircraft and you could still hear it.
Okay, so you keep referring back to this deal that was made between Tradeport and the city in 1994. What exactly do you find changed or more offensive, let's say, since that agreement was signed?
Well, I guess the part about the agreement that is unfortunate is that because it is between a private-public consortium, that most of it has been kept quiet. I won't say it's top secret. It hasn't been released to the public, so we don't really know what the details of the agreement are.
Can now, they do that, though? I thought anything to do with airports, there had to be public consultation if there was a residential area within, what, 6 miles or something of it.
I don't know the actual details of that. I do know that a big part of the lease agreement that exists between the city and Tradeport is kept confidential. Now, in 1996, and we're just coming up to that very, it's the 10-year point in the relationship, parts of the agreement then become public. And the part that is going to be, I think, of keen interest to a lot of people is there's a revenue sharing that begins in 1996. The city is entitled to a percentage, I believe, of the overall revenue that is generated by the airport. So I think that the community is going to get a firsthand look at what is the true economic benefit of the airport.
So do you think that this agreement, this public-private agreement, is dictating maybe some zoning changes or some of the decisions that are coming out of City Hall?
That's a tough question to ask. That would be my surmising a lot of things that are happening up around the airport. I think that the city has clearly communicated to the public that they believe that the development of the airport and this proposed Aerotropolis is our last great economic hope. And it would, I guess I'd have to be pretty naive to believe that this partnership, that we're not doing certain things to ensure the viability of that airport. As I said earlier, one of its major competitive advantages is the fact that it has fairly unrestricted operations, 24/7, 365 is the way they refer to it.
That worries me.
The city has a history, and there are numerous examples of it dating back to the mid-1800s, where the city has made planning decisions around industrial needs. And I think one of the biggest examples is the Bayfront. Back in the early 1900s, the city, back then, you can imagine, it was probably quite normal for people to want to reside next to the Bayfront, the water. It was, a place for recreational activity. It was actually a source of food for a lot of the classes of people that lived in and around the Bayfront. And the city, because we had a big economic opportunity, and this is where I could probably get myself into a lot of trouble, but they rezoned a tremendous amount of the land that's in and around the front of the Bayshore as industrial land, and that was to help Stelco so that they could have industrial encroachment into a lot of the residential areas. Unfortunately, it did happen that it hurt probably the people that needed the land the most, and that was a lot of the working class and the lower-income people.
What we want to do right now is basically show people how this deal was put together, why it's a bad way to do business, who it's hurting, how it's going to hurt people in the future. Craig, do you want to wade in here as a local representative and let us know how has the changes that Mike was talking about with the airport and the activity, how has it affected your farming area?
We lost, when they expanded the runway in 1981, we lost part of the farm, and then we bought another farm on the, shall we say, the other side of the runway. I live about a quarter mile from the actual side of the runway. It's funny, we probably get less noise there than people who live further out underneath the flight path, such that very rarely do I have problems with the noise. It's kind of interesting watching the planes take off, and I really don't mind it. My family has been in the area since 1801. We grow grain, corn, winter wheat, soybeans, oats, barley, and peas, which goes, like the oats, barley, and peas is fed to our hog operation. It's a small one that's in the area. It's an area where you have extremely good soils. A lot of Hamilton, the soils are not that good. Where we are in Ancaster, the soils are deep. It's about 150 feet to bedrock where I am. It's stone-free, which you might not think about, but when you're driving a piece of equipment, dropping even a 10-pound rock through a piece of equipment that costs $250,000, the damage can be incredible. So we're stone-free. It's a silt loam type of soil, which is very drought-resistant. And right where we are, we can probably grow crops. Some of our crops can be at least 30% better than the average of the entire Hamilton area.
I wanted to ask you another question after that because you piqued my curiosity. When you're talking about soil levels, there's a lot of sod farming going on up there, and I've heard different complaints about sod farms. The most major complaint is that the sod farm rips up the topsoil when it's harvested. Now, I have heard other reports that says, no, sod farming saves the soil. What's your take on that type of farming? Does it damage the soil or is it helping the soil?
It's kind of a mixed reaction there. It does add organic matter. The one thing I do have against them is that their tillage practices are such that they grind the soil, you know, down to small particles. Then they keep pounding it until it's dust, and then they keep pounding it until it's powder. Does make the ground very hard. The water just runs off rather than soaks in. It's still considered a type of farming. The alternative is to go back to what they used to, where they had to use seed on the new surveys, and then that caused for erosion. Whereas they can, you know, if they time it right, they don't have too much erosion when there's their turf grass.
Depending on how it's harvested, you said, and I've seen a lot of the new machinery since I was just up there yesterday. How many sod farms are new? I can't believe how many sod farms there are up there, and in my recollection, they've sort of just grown, sprung out of nowhere. How long have they been going up there?
Hamilton sod's been there for a long time. Can't give you figures on exactly how long they've been, you know, any of these have been in operation, but Hamilton sod's been there for a long, long time.
Fields are being changed into sod farm from something else?
More so in Binbrook area rather than in Ancaster. Binbrook, it's a little bit flatter. They like flatter ground, so that's more seems to be where the development is going on.
Yes, and what kind of crops are these sod farms replacing, do you know?
It would be like, you know, the corn, soybeans, wheat. Okay. Primarily, some hay fields.
You also were saying that the flight path doesn't bother you so much, but they did expropriate some of your land. Do you think that you got a fair market price for the land they took from you?
Yeah. In a short answer, yes. It would be a fair market value, yes.
What about the pollution of the jet fuel? What about the pollution of all these new urban planning subdivisions that are going on in there? Is that going to affect your water table? Is it going to affect your crops?
Water table... I was concerned about it when they put in the runway, but it has not affected it at all. When they put in roads, now we have noticed a difference. The one farm is right beside the new number 6, and we have noticed a little bit more water, of course, coming off the highway, because every time you pave over or roof over an area, you know, the water can't soak into the ground. So there's always the potential for immediate runoff. Now, they're supposed to, when they do new development, to put up these ponds that like stormwater ponds, which are supposed to, you know, hold the water and release it at the rate that it was there before. That remains to be seen. Of course, we have seen, I don't have problems, but I have seen other farms, the salt usage has gone up, and you'll see if you go down, say, Fiddler's Green, there are some small areas where you can see salt damage. There's no question about it in the fields.
Yes, and along that new Highway 6, I've seen the damage on the pine trees that line the highway already. So there is airborne pollution, and I do think it may affect the crops out there. But more importantly, have you noticed how many new urban subdivisions are going on up there and how fast we're losing farmland in your neighborhood?
That is a bit of a beef of mine. This council, I'm a little bit different from Michael. I'm not part of his group. And I have no problem with the airport influence area, which restricts residential development. It's long overdue. This airport is there. We've got to live with it. And yet they allowed the councils, not necessarily this today's council, but previous councils have allowed development there in Mount Hope, corner of the old number 6 and Whitechurch Road. There's a brand new survey. It's still going in. It's over 100 homes, and it's less than a mile from the airport. To my way of thinking, you know, it was just sheer craziness to allow that kind of development right next to the airport. And with farming practices, there's a lot of things that I do. You know, sometimes there's been occasion I work all night planting a crop. Hopefully my neighbors will put up with it, because it's only maybe once every couple of years that I'm, you know, weather conditions force me to run all night. There's certainly dust. There's certainly with hog operation when I spread manure, there's definitely odors. We have spent over $70,000, and it's increasing on a yearly basis, to control odors. We're moderately successful. Do a public relations campaign basically with my neighborhood to let them know what I'm doing, because they don't understand what I'm doing. I've been asked what I've added to the manure to make it smell so bad. And on the contrary, I've used some products that have reduced odor. The more housing you allow into an agricultural area, the more problems you tend to develop.
Do these developments, I mean, have you spoken to the developers and said, look, there's going to be a problem if you build and sell homes here unless you explain this to them? Or?
I haven't got any surveys that close to me. The homes that I have more of the problem with are 40 years old. And it's only a few that don't understand. Most of them, again, like with the public relations, I have gone out sometimes in the wintertime and clear their driveways if we've had a heavy snowfall, because they can't, a 6 or 8 inch snowfall, you know, soggy, wet, they can't handle it. And I've gone out with the tractor and spent, you know, a morning clearing it. And, you know, you get a chance to talk with them and you let them know what's going on, and it does make a difference. It's a long-term process, but it does help.
Yeah, once people understand why things do the way they do or smell the way they smell.
Yeah, it's an education process.
Okay, Michael, getting back to you and this group that you have, I'm interested if you could explain more what it is you're doing with this group, what you hope to achieve, and why you put it together. Why did you send all those flyers around?
Well, first off, I should say that, you know, we keep referring to a group, and there is real no formal official group. I have a number of people that I talk with, meet with, and we have a like opinion on what's happening. I think it's important to note that, like Craig, I don't disagree with the need for the development. As a business owner, I am somewhat perplexed in that we've made a fairly major decision without a lot of information. And I think that's one of my big beefs, is that what we get is a lot of lip service and rhetoric from the city, but we don't get a lot of hard facts. Repeatedly, we are being told that there's going to be no public money spent to do this development. No public money spent up in the airport. Even as early as last week, one of our counselors in the press said there's going to be minimal or essentially no public money being spent on this Aerotropolis development. And yet there are studies that go back as early as 2003 that were commissioned by the city, and in fact internal reports that said there's just absolutely no way that you can develop this property without public money. A good example and proof of that is the industrial park up in Flamborough, where on the council meeting of June the 29th, Councillor Braden explained to all of council that they injected almost $300,000 per acre in order to develop that area, and yet they're selling it for $65,000 per acre because they just couldn't get any uptake. They couldn't get private development in there. And my fear is that's exactly what's going to happen up in the Aerotropolis or the airport area. And tell me how this is going to impact the inner city. Explain to me how taking that money away from the inner areas of the city, where we do have a lot of infrastructure problems, is better spent up in that area. There's a lot of misinformation that's been put out there, a lot of exaggerated claims about how we're going to create 50,000 jobs. This study that was conducted and commissioned by the city in 2003 said that the average number of jobs per acre in the Hamilton area was around 7, and yet we're using the provincial average of 15. And, you know, you can do the math yourself. At the low end, we're going to be around 20,000. At the high end, we're going to be around 50,000.
And what kind of jobs are they going to be?
Yeah, that's the there's a belief that because the airport is there, that we're going to attract a particular kind of job. And yet, there's been numerous studies that have been done all over North America that say that that's not exactly exactly the way it works. The kinds of industries that would locate specifically around an airport are service industries that would use an airport and would want to use an airport. Hamilton, it certainly says it's an international airport, but the only true international carrier no longer exists there, passenger carrier.
And that was
U.S. Air.
US Air. Maybe they'll come back or something.
Well, that's a possibility. I think that they ran out of that operation for about 7 or 8 years, and they just didn't find that it was economically viable, and they decided to leave. My feeling is, again, being a business owner, give me the information. Let me make an educated decision. I was quite dismayed on the council meeting of the 29th when, of the 12 councillors that were there, 8 of them, their rationale for moving forward with this was just solely on the basis that we've been talking about this for so many years, we just need to go ahead and do it.
The councillors may have, but a lot of the people in the audience didn't know about it. And the other problem that seems to be consistent with Hamilton public meetings is the fact that they only got, 6 days' notice to suddenly realize what was going on up there?
Well, the official notice that the city normally uses came out in the paper on May the 13th. That's a Friday, and there's a section in the paper where they issue all of the tenders and notices. So they met the requirements of the Planning Act in notifying the public. And as I understand it, it was at the request of Councillors Ferguson and Mitchell that all of the affected homeowners and landowners in the airport influence area be sent a letter. And that was, it arrived at our house on June the 1st, and it was dated May the 31st. And I think, Craig, you probably got one around the same time. So it was a 3-page letter, and it explained what the proposed amendments to the various official plans were. I could very well see that this was a massive change that they were contemplating. And in the letter, it notified us that the report from the Planning and Development Committee was available to us on the morning of the 6th for a public meeting, is the way it was described, on the 7th. Now, it wasn't a specially held public meeting. It was a regularly scheduled standing committee meeting of the Planning and Development Committee. And that's normally what they would do. If somebody wanted to put a stop sign at the end of their street and it needed to go before the committee, they would just use that as a committee. But this is not a stop sign at the end of a street. So I was a bit disappointed that a dedicated public meeting wasn't held before the decision process was done. And I think that I unfortunately couldn't attend that meeting. My wife was there. My understanding is there were about 200 people that crammed the council chambers. And I think the general consensus by the people that were there that gave is basically a farce.
They were told what was going to happen. There's very few serious considerations were given to people's complaints. There was a lot of complaints, a lot of worry from what I understood, and council just basically ignored it. Ignored all the outcry. They're moving ahead. We're just having this public consultation because that's what we have to do. That's the impression a lot of people were left with. So if you wanted to summarize all the things that you think are wrong with the way this Aerotropolis plan has been put together, do you think you could do that?
Well, I guess the process, for starters, would be a big one on my side of the table. For something as massive as this, I think it requires more than just a separate little committee meeting. You need to have a lot of public debate. This will forever change the landscape of the area. It will forever change Hamilton as a city. So I think it does require a lot of public debate. So the process is certainly high on my list. And then the fact that we're moving ahead without a lot of background information in order to be making what I would call a very sound, intelligent, and educated decision. The council has taken the position that this is just the first step of the process. And I agree, okay, it's the first step of the process. But it's like a freight train. Once you start that freight train up and it's moving along and you've got to slow down or you've got to stop, it makes it even more difficult. I've distinctly recall when council announced the decision to go ahead with the link, the Lincoln-Alexander, and a lot of the lands were being bought up by developers, and then I don't recall the reason that there was a possibility that they weren't going to go ahead with it. I distinctly remember the articles in the front page of the paper about how developers were going to turn around and sue the city. So, you had these visions that when the council approved the decision on the 29th that there were developers out there just wringing their hands in glee. The ball has been set in motion. The city has clearly sent a message to the development community. We're going to go ahead with this. And they do have some rationale. They say, well, why would this province go ahead and spend $35 million on an extension of the number 6 highway if they didn't believe that this was important? And you can spin it any way you want.
But then why did the province, when they stopped and looked at the plan for the Atropolis, want to stop it?
Well, again, you know, that's a difference of opinion. The city would say that it was from a mid-level bureaucrat and didn't have all the information on there. The city's clearly moving in the direction that they are, from what I have read, because the whole process gets to be a lot more difficult once the Places to Grow Act becomes legislation. It's now passed third reading and it just needs royal assention, which, as I understand it, should come by the end of the summer. And it clearly says in the Places to Grow Act that the province will be part of any sort of discussions and planning regarding urban boundary expansions.
Yeah, I think you hit it right on the head. That is how the city operates, and I think they get a lot of their advice and decision-making from developers and lawyers like David Estrin, who know the environmental laws quite intimately and can throw up these roadblocks. And one of the roadblocks I've seen used in this city time and time again is exactly what you're citing. Move as fast as you can. Put as much money as you possibly can into the project. Try to get ahead of the law, whatever's going to be changing. And then if something happens and you have people like David Estrin standing up and saying, well, we'll just sue the government because, you know, we've lost money now. The other topic I wanted to get to, gentlemen, because we are running out of time here, is the fact that the city has decided that Maple Leaf Foods should relocate there, that it's a good place for them to put that plant. And then some of the public outcry is, okay, Mr. Smith here has hog farm, so he might understand this problem. But basically, it's a slaughterhouse for pigs, and it has a lot of odor with it. So does either one of you care to comment on that issue?
The one thing I would like to point out that it'll be a brand new plant with presumably the most modern technology that's available. The plant there in Burlington is, I believe, about 40 years old. Believe me, in the farming industry, with regards to odor and stuff like that, we have seen major changes over the last 40 years. So it may not be as bad as what they get in Burlington. I don't know. But I would suspect that there's going to be there's going to be better technology involved there. There certainly will be odors. There's, you know, you bring that number of hogs in, there's going to be some odors. But it may not be as bad as they think. I don't know.
The only thing I could add to that would be that, I guess, two things. I would agree with Craig, as you said, that the new technology you got to hope it will reduce the odors in that area. You always, in instances like this, get the old not in my backyard syndrome. And, you know, I think we all enjoy pork. I know I do. And that's a difficult, difficult situation. But if you look at the zoning in that park right now, and I don't profess that I've gone and looked at this in detail, but my understanding is that it currently is not, it's zoned for industrial, but it's not zoned to allow that type of operation.
You're right.
So the city is going to have to go in and rezone that land. So somewhere in the past, somebody has made the decision that for this particular area with the type of residential development that's around it, that it can't support that kind of industry. The process as we go forward, if Maple Leaf does to make a decision that they want to relocate there, is then they're going to have to rezone that property. And my first thought is that the city is very, very desperate. And when you're desperate, you perhaps make bad decisions. So that we're now going to go and have to undo something that somebody in the past has made a decision was a good thing and say, well, we're going to do this. We're going to change it in order to bring these jobs. And, you know, they put jobs at the forefront. Jobs, you know, how can you
not? Yeah, but what kind of jobs? I mean, surely if we're pushing the airport and we're calling Hamilton a transportation hub, you could maybe look at IT type of jobs and use some of those brains that are coming out of McMaster University, research jobs. Why does it always have to be a smelly industrial manufacturing or processing type of job?
Again, to what Craig has said, that there's a lot of new technology out there, and it may not be as bad, but we don't know. So it would be the first major company in that park. And I know from my own experience in the industrial park that my company is located in, I hate to use the expression, but birds of a feather flock together. Other companies of a like nature will feel that it's now, because it's been rezoned, a good place to locate. So the situation potential has the potential to get worse, not better. Let's face it, if there are already a dozen high-tech companies like my own in that area, it's not likely that they would have a pig slaughtering facility located in that area.
That this land is non-primary agricultural land, and it's not being farmed anyway. Well, I stayed up one night, didn't sleep too well, and started thinking about that. And there's approximately 3,000 acres that they're talking about there. I had no problems coming up with 1,800 acres that was being actively farmed. It could be, you know, 2,000 or above. It's a little hard to tell because of some of the tree lines and stuff like this. Obviously, that is the majority of it is being farmed. As far as non-prime, well, we have a potato growing operation in the area. We have a mid-size market garden. We have a sweet corn operation. You have, I mentioned the corn, like grain corn, soybeans, wheat, oats, barley, and peas. There's dairy operations, and they grow hay. There's a couple of beef operations, beef farms. There's my own little small hog operation. You have a nursery crop operation. The market garden operation, you do not grow that successfully on poor land. You need top quality land for growing a lot of these crops. And like I said, my own experience, some of my crops are at minimum 30% over the old county average. So it's not non-prime land that we're talking about here. Now, I mentioned like it was about 2,000 acres more or less that was farmland. The other 1,000 acres, approximately, it's the headwaters of the Chippewa Creek, also known as the Welland River.
And what its long-term impact on the future will have on us, it seems to me as we look to continue this idea of urban sprawl, it's going to draw more and more people away from the central core of the city. What's it going to do to the central core there? We've already got a large number of groups there that are trying to rebuild the core of the city, and yet we're going to focus our efforts elsewhere. We're putting a lot of hope here in and around an airport, and yet, as I've maybe stated, world price of oil has got nowhere to go but up. Very few people, I think, at council have put any real substance to that potentially happening. So that has the ability to really have a major impact.
I got to agree with you there. Margaret McCarthy has been quite an outspoken councillor on city council lately, and one of the few out of the handful that we have that actually question, add the right questions, and try to make sense of this. Can either of you gentlemen think of places people should go to understand what peak oil is all about, and urban crawl and sprawl? And maybe, Craig, you could mention...
Let's go back to 9/11. One of the vegetable marketing boards, their president was on record for stating that if it had been 2/11 instead, the stores would have looked a lot different because the border was closed. No question about it. This is not fiction or a hypothesis. It was closed. So nothing was moving up from the States, nothing from Mexico. In September, the 9/11, the grocery stores, their stock only lasts a few days before they had to replenish it. They went out to the Holland Marsh and all the other areas, and they bought up everything in sight to keep the stores full of fresh fruits and vegetables. I have a neighbor who is a linesman for Ontario Hydro. He got sent out to the ice storm area there, Eastern Ontario. And he said it wasn't his big problem was not that he wasn't being paid. He was being paid well. He was warm. He was busy. He had a job. But he didn't know where he was going to eat because he said the stores, there was a run on them. They were cleaned out in a day of all the food that, you know, could be eaten without, you know, being cooked. We need to, yes, water is important. Air is important. But we got to pay a little bit more attention to our food supply. A very effective transportation system that we've been able to keep the food supply running.
You brought up a very good point. When peak oil hits, and it's already hit here in North America, but when the effects of it are going to really make themselves known in society, what Craig has been pointing out here is you will not be able to find food in your grocery store, because if you go now and look at the labels of where our fruit and vegetables come from, they're from Chile, they're from the States. We've been paving over our farmlands here and saying that they're no good rather than till the soil and regenerate the soil and keep some soil free from industry, free from houses and residential land. land being plopped on top of them so that we can grow our own food. This is a fruit belt. It was a world-renowned fruit belt area, and now it's becoming a transportation hub. So that's a very important point to remember, folks.
And just one last comment about what Craig has just alluded to. I've probably traveled around the world 10 times. I've seen virtually every country in the world, and in no other place that I can think of, except in North America, have we had such an incredible abundance of food and land and cheap oil. It's coming to an end, and we have to be careful. I would agree with Craig that we need to find ways to grow our fruit more locally, and the days of the 3,000-mile Caesar salad are over, and we're going to see more and more of those impacts.
Really, thank you, gentlemen, for coming in. I hope you come back and fill us in as things go on up there, and we'll talk to you in the future, I'm sure. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.